Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Lee Cantor here with our fearless producer, Katie Galley. How are you doing, Katie?
Doing great, Lee. How about you?
I am doing A-OK. I'm excited about this episode because this is one of my favorite series we do here is the Marketing Superheroes series. And we got an esteemed author, Pamela Slim. How are you doing, Pam?
I am doing great.
Now, Pam, can you talk a little bit about your background and how you got into marketing and the history of you? I guess you got onto my radar early on with your first book. Was it Cubicle Nation back then?
Yes, Escape from Cubicle Nation.
So talk about that path.
Definitely. I have been self-employed for 23 years. And the first 10 years or so, I was a consultant to large companies. And through that experience, I loved it. I worked on the human side of business. And it was really a word of mouth kind of a business. I met all kinds of wonderful people. Toward the end, especially, I met a lot of people who were in corporate who were interested in leaving to start a business. So really, my whole foray into the world of marketing and online marketing was in 2005 when I started the Escape from Cubicle Nation blog. And that was a career shift. I was moving from being a consultant to corporations to specifically helping individuals from corporate leave to start a business. And it really was the growth of that. Those folks who have been around the internet for a while remember, 2005 was a really a time of a lot of growth within blogging. And I learned all about ways to communicate with people online through writing and then through the growth of social media, ended up building a really wonderful, thriving community of friends and clients and other people who were doing work in this arena.
And now you can't you're unhirable, right? You couldn't have a real job, right?
I pity the person who who would hire me to work in a firm. It's hard after 23 years to imagine doing it. I do want to state, though, for the record, that I totally support and understand people who choose to do that. I am not one of these people who had a bad experience in corporate. I actually really enjoyed my time in corporate, and it can be a great choice for some people. I think within entrepreneurship, sometimes we get way over on the side of saying you can only be free and creative if you work for yourself. I don't believe that to be true.
Now, in your recent work, did you do a survey of some kind that kind of talked about the different feelings that small business owners have towards how they approach learning or how they approach the different obstacles they have when they're trying to grow their business?
Yeah. So one of the newest things that I've done is actually to open a brick and mortar small business learning laboratory here in downtown Mesa, Arizona, where I live. It's just about 20 minutes from the Phoenix airport. And in the construction of that, I think having worked with people virtually for so many years online, I really have felt called to also do work in my local community, to do it with local entrepreneurs and also do it more on a regional level where we can be collaborating with our city government, with economic development, with the arts, with all of this great energy that's happening here in Mesa about really growing our economy and especially focus on growing innovation and really the skills of creative people. So as part of that, myself and my friend Susan Beyer from Audience Audit and Chris Lee, we created a survey where we had it co-sponsored by the Cloud Software Association, which is basically the trade association for all the folks that make all the apps we use to run our business. So people like FreshBooks or Wave and Infusionsoft, Google. And so we surveyed over 2,000 small business owners, and we specifically were looking to attitudes that small business owners have toward obstacles. Because as a coach for so many years, I will tell you that everybody I work with probably has a pretty good sense of what it is that they should be doing, including myself, right? We all know we should be doing more outbound marketing and talking to more folks and so forth to grow our business. But it's often our attitude toward challenge or obstacles that's the thing that determines our success or failure. So we got great, interesting, rich data about different attitudes that people have. And then we're using the data also about the problems people have to actually structure our learning laboratory so that we focus on 5 problems a year, and we'll be testing and trying all kinds of creative solutions to help people overcome those obstacles.
And what are some of the obstacles that people had?
Some of the top ones, not surprising, are getting more customers, right? So that's one where people can, the core problems as they articulated them were things like getting more customers, dealing with cash flow. It was about 85% of all the survey respondents from all different types of businesses across the US and Canada face uncertainty from month to month about their cash flow. And you can just imagine the impact that that has on people psychologically, but also on the business, and not predictably being able to figure out, can you meet payroll? Can you invest in your business? So those are key things that people struggle with. Definitely time, how it is that they can manage all the things that need to be done in their business were some of the really big problems or challenges. And in terms of specific obstacles, really within each of these problem areas, it's everything from the things, you know, I see every day with clients where somebody might have an objective where they have a plan for reaching out and meeting with new clients. And so they may send out a series of emails to people maybe they've had some past contact with. And an obstacle for one business owner could be that they send out three emails and they don't get any response from all three, or they get a response from somebody saying they're not interested. For some people, even though it's just three emails, they consider that to be a major obstacle, a failure. They start to doubt themselves. And as you can imagine, from my perspective, I'm thinking, geez, that's only three.
Right. That's not enough
data. Let's multiply that by 100, by 1,000, right. Because it takes a lot in order to be successful.
Now, how are you defining small business owner? Because a lot of people have different definitions. I'm sure the government definition of small business owner is different than the one you're using.
Yeah, well, we use, for the survey, we did use the purvey of what the government uses for the SBA. So I think it's up to 10 million in sales and 500 employees. We had a much more the people who responded to the survey who were on the smaller side. So solopreneurs or folks that had, you know, up to 10 employees. That for me, historically, not surprisingly, doing a lot of work in early stage entrepreneurship from corporate to entrepreneur, you know, has a lot of people who are just beginning, or there's also a whole sector of people who really have chosen to work for themselves because they want the freedom and flexibility. And they actually don't want to grow and scale their business. They like the flexibility of being a freelancer or a contractor and really choose to set it up just for that reason. So they can travel more or have more time to spend with their kids or whatever their priorities are.
Now, when a person kind of is that type of a person, a solopreneur, aren't there just different strategies that you would, if you were coaching them, give them in terms of growing their business than the person that is trying to create that kind of process-oriented, replicable business model?
You know, what's interesting is actually a lot of the frameworks apply whether you're doing it on a smaller scale or a bigger scale. And then there are for sure some unique differentiators, you know, and it also depends, I think, on the stage of business that somebody is in and also kind of what their personality is. I've heard a common saying that in the really early stages of business that your main job is to say yes, right? Yes to opportunities, yes to testing and trying things, yes to working with all kinds of different people to figure out where you fit in the market, who's really willing to pay for your services, et cetera. As you begin to get more stable and more focused, then you really focus on saying no. You narrow your focus in order to scale. So there's certain behaviors like that that will look differently. But a common framework that I share with anybody that I work with is not just thinking about yourself as a singular person who's out there trying to reach your customers, that you're actually part of a broader ecosystem of other people, other providers, other technology companies, other thought leaders who are also trying to bring solutions to that person who you want to serve. And to me, that idea of an ecosystem, of knowing that you're part of an overall system that's helping the person that you want to help, is very useful because it can focus your effort and attention, and it can also open up a lot of possibilities in the case that you really want to scale your business for looking at who might be great partners, who might be great investors, co-marketing activities, et cetera.
Now, when you're looking at marketing that holistically, can you share, like, maybe kind of map that out? What would that look like? Say I'm an accountant and I'm really good with dentists, and that's my specialty. How would I build out that ecosystem?
So what you would think of is for that dentist who you want to help, right? For that particular practice and type of dentist, in order for them to successfully build their practice, they are looking for information. They are utilizing products and services that help them to grow. So you have really stellar accounting services that you can be providing to them. They probably also need technology. They need software in order to do their billing. They probably are connected with marketing people. I actually know so many marketing folks who focus on the dental market because, of course, there are dentist offices everywhere. So there might be a digital marketing agency that they're working with in order to spread the word about what they're doing. They might use a certain customer relationship management software in order to, you know, manage their leads, to follow up with people. They belong to specialty associations for dentists. They may follow the work of the esteemed thought leader dentists that exist because they exist within every field. And so as you see, and you begin to look at all these places where they're looking for information, support, and resources in order to have a thriving dental practice, those are the places where you want to be. So let's say you go to this association meeting for dentists. I always encourage people to be the weirdo in the room. So you may be the only non-dentist person in that room as an accountant, but you can't walk one foot without bumping into another dentist who would be an ideal person for you.
And that's
why it becomes a lot more efficient in terms of marketing when you're going to these watering holes of places where other people are reaching the same people who you were trying to reach.
And that's a little counterintuitive for some people, right? They think that, oh, I'm an accountant. I better join the accountant society in my city. Whereas they might be better served joining that watering hole of whoever their kind of target market is.
It's so right. And I understand it. It feels good for us to be in our communities of practice. And I think it's a part of what we need in order to develop and retain mastery in our given field. So it's fine to be a part of the accounting association, but you probably won't find a lot of clients there because who are there? A bunch of other accountants who are looking for clients. Coaches are famous for doing the same thing,
right?
Going to coaching conferences and hanging out with coaches, and everybody's talking about how hard it is to find clients. So I'm always saying, hey, I'm over here with the, you know, Software Engineers Association of America, talking to people who could be great coaching clients who are software engineers.
You know,
it is counterintuitive and it's less comfortable to be the weirdo in the room. But often the things that make you uncomfortable are also the things that really make you innovative and make your business really successful.
Now, I was talking with a young entrepreneur recently, and he was having a problem feeling that he was qualified enough to be an expert in his space. Do you ever deal with experts that are feel maybe that they're not an expert enough to really counsel or to charge money or charge a lot of money for a service?
The whole idea of expertise and mastery is one I'm really interested in. And I have a couple of thoughts about it. So on one hand, in the way that we are often teaching marketing and the way that we're helping people think about how it is that you position yourself in your field is to underline the fact that you are an expert. And in particular, that you must be the best expert ever, right? You're the one who's the person to talk to if somebody needs to have their problem solved. And I understand that. People want to feel like they're in competent hands, like you have some experience solving the problem that you're hired to solve. At the same time, that focus sometimes can make people forget, like in the case maybe of the person you were talking to, that you really do need to start somewhere. I don't think you should start a business if you fundamentally don't believe that you have experience, relevant experience for you to solve the problem, right? You might want to get some more training. You might want to volunteer some time in order to make sure that you're confident with it. I remember when I first started Escape from Cubicle Nation, and although I had been a consultant for 10 years and had worked with a lot of people as a coach, the first time that I was actually coaching somebody to leave corporate to start a business, I had done it myself, but I didn't have a huge body of expertise around doing that. So from that perspective, I had to lean on the skills and experience I had before of understanding people, understanding career paths and strengths and all of that. My favorite phrase during those early years was, I don't know, but I will find out. So you can be relentlessly dedicated to solving somebody's problem, knowing that you're accurately trusting the fact that you are competent, that you have a strong circle of support, right? That you can be relentless about finding an answer. And to me, I'm always very thankful about my early clients, right? Because I didn't have the answer to every question. I was very dedicated to getting the answer for them. And what was interesting is over time, I think that's part of what allowed me pretty quickly to create a really powerful circle of other experts around me, my ecosystem, right? People like Seth Godin and Guy Kawasaki and Jeff and Rich Sloan from Startup Nation and all kinds of other people who really became great resources where I could share their information with my clients. So there, you know, on one side, we want to be honest with ourselves to make sure we're not just, you know, on a whim promising to do something that we really don't feel that we're competent at doing. At the same time, you really have to be aware that the only way to really be building those skills and experience is by doing it and working with real people. So sometimes that means, you know, spending that time with a couple of core people who fit your ideal client profile. You may choose to not charge them for the services the first couple of times that you do it, so that you can feel confident and they can feel confident that you know what you're doing. And then over time, you really want to be, you know, developing the expertise so that you can stand on it and charge for it.
And not everybody starts out as a Pam Slim, but everybody has a first client.
Exactly. I mean, you look at anybody who's been first at doing anything, right? It's just when you don't have those skills and that experience, we all have that beginner mind. We all, you know, we all are just learning a lot as we go. The focus of being very relentless toward solving that problem, getting to a resolution, is a really important one. And that's why another reason why I feel like it's so important to have a circle of experts, mentors, you know, peers around you, so that in those early days, you can really get the support. I remember when I first started consulting after I left my full-time job, and it was a very similar experience. It was terrifying when I was, you know, by myself somewhere, you know, New Orleans, leading a group of executives in an offsite meeting, and I got to a stuck point, and I had somebody who I had worked with before who had already been in that situation that helped walk me through and teach me as I was going. So, you know, it's funny. I did martial arts for many years, and I would always notice folks who might walk in the door, and the first thing they would see is they would look at the really advanced students and they'd be like, I want to do that. Like, how quickly can I do that? And I found, not surprisingly, those were often folks that either got hurt or they lasted a very short time.
Right.
The folks that I really appreciated were those that walked in the door, were very respectful and said, you know, where is the starting place? And even if they had done another style of martial art, I did capoeira, the Afro-Brazilian martial art, and then I did mixed martial arts, you know, but even if they came from a background of something else, they had beginner's mind, they were respectful, they did the work that needed to be done. They did the sit-ups, the push-ups, the repetitions, the, you know, getting your face smashed in the mat a million times by somebody better and stronger. And by respecting that process, that's really where they begin to develop that mastery, you know? So that's the problem I have when we start to tell everybody that you must position yourself as the top expert in the field. You actually need to develop expertise in your field. But the paradox is you do have to start somewhere, and we are often capable of more than we think that we are, right? You have to be dedicated, realistic. And if you get yourself in over your head, you better know who you can call in order to help you through so that you can serve that client in the way that you promise them.
And at the heart of it is these kind of foundational skills of having a network, being transparent and saying, I don't know, being willing to do the extra work to find the person that can help, being, you know, having integrity and being sincere about trying to serve and help people. That really goes a long way in giving you that kind of the opportunities to develop the mastery.
I really think they do. It's one of the great benefits of getting older and just having some more decades under me is I just recognize every year that goes by how fundamental having an ethical framework is, you know, how fundamental it is to truly respect and treat your clients well, right? To as much as you possibly can, to be doing things the right way, to not say yes to projects that you know that you really can't deliver on. You know, we all have had our lessons along the way. It's never a perfect journey. I just taught a class last year called Consulting Foundations. And it was, there's a lot of people who, again, might read a book or hear like, hey, you know, you hate your job, just be a consultant. You know?
Right.
So I sit back there cringing because I think, oh my gosh, actually to be a consultant is, has a very important skills. There's all kinds of capabilities that you need to have in order to do it effectively.
Right.
So I wanted
it doesn't
to be
mean you're
somebody's...
just it doesn't mean you're just unemployed. Like there's more
exactly.
to it than that.
Right. And just because you've been an excellent individual contributor in a role does not mean that you have the skills in order to be a consultant. There are very specific things to manage that business, to manage the engagement, you know, that are, it's kind of a layered process. But what was so interesting to me is one of the core classes that we did was on developing your values and your ethics and really seeing how fundamental that that is to everything it is that you do in order to be effective as a consultant. And it was, we had such great engagement in that area. And it wasn't until I really reflected on it as I was thinking about how would I want to be training and teaching new consultants that I realized like this, you have to get this part. You have to. It's not just about packaging and, you know, what's pricing that you can sell and what's the way to make the most profit. Like if you don't have an ethical lens, it will be very difficult to do the work and it will be very difficult to maintain a reputation throughout the decades.
Right. That's sustainable. Now, getting back to marketing a little bit for a small business owner, how does the small business owner protect themselves from just it seems that there's a new channel to market, you know, starting almost, you know, every month there's a new one. And how do they know which one to choose and which one to get good at?
Yeah, well, so I like to think of it where you do know, as you said, it's very difficult to be good at multiple channels. And so some of the quick ways that you can begin to sort through is, on one hand, knowing yourself. So knowing what really are a lot of your core skills and strengths. I know for me, I realized a little bit later in life, like after starting to blog, that, hey, I actually have always loved writing. I'm a good writer. That's a core strength. And so writing is something that has ended up being a really strong marketing and a way to connect with people. Other people can be great on video or, you know, great on audio. And so that's part of how you can think of what might be a good channel is strengths that you have in communication. It has to be met also by what are the marketing vehicles and channels that the people who you want to reach actually utilize, right? So if you're trying to reach my kids, 10 and 12 year old market, and you're not on YouTube, forget it. Like they spend hours, you know,
right.
looking at slime videos. And that's such a primary channel that even if you don't feel like you're really good with video, that's part of what you might need to look and have somebody else do those videos for you, right? Because for that particular audience, that's a really prime channel. So looking at this fit between where are places where people are, generally with the new tool a week and all these, you know, cool things you should be doing, there is a rate of adoption. And so there may be some people, if part of the psychographics of your audience are people who are always on the cutting edge of tech and they're early adopters and so forth, right? Then you may want to be experimenting with some of these tools. But fundamentally, I would look at what might be two or, you know, maybe three primary channels that you would look at. Folks that are doing a lot of B2B, you know, business to business kind of marketing, LinkedIn, you know, is a great solid primary kind of source, especially people that are in professional services where it's just, you know, understood that that's a platform in which people are doing business. People doing a lot more business to consumer kinds of business. Facebook, of course, you know, is an area where you want to be. So where you're able to develop some core channels and have a really great strategy there. And then when your business is doing well, where you then have the resources maybe to have people share efficiently on other channels that are emerging, it can be a fun place in which you can be experimenting and playing, right? And maybe meeting some really cool clients. But you're right. If you're chasing every new thing that comes down the pike, you'll be wasting a lot of your time.
So you feel it's better to go deep in a couple places and really immerse yourself rather than go shallow in a lot of places.
I do. And one of the nice things about business is you you do know what works and what doesn't, right? You can ask people, you can track where it is that people are coming from. And that's one of the benefits of often using the tools that are related to social media channels, is that you can actually get a clear sense about the results of your marketing activities. But just having such a dispersed energy, is it becomes very, very difficult to keep that up. And again, depending upon the type of business that you're in, some people spend huge amounts of time focused on content marketing and social media, when in fact, they may be in the kind of business that's ship driven, where developing a relationship with three or four core people could actually end up leading to more business than they ever wanted. You know I have a colleague of mine who's nowhere on social media, has never written a blog, nothing. I don't even know if she has a LinkedIn profile. And she's probably making over $1 million a year as a very strategic consultant, because she has a very refined network of people who know what she does. And that's really all that she needs.
Now, are there any, are there kind of marketing activities that you would recommend, like once you kind of do an inventory of your skills, the places that your clients are hanging out, or the contacts you want to get close to are hanging out, are there any kind of activities that you recommend people be doing on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think the key is regular basis. So my friend Susan Beyer, who's the person who did the survey for us, the attitudinal segmentation survey, I love her philosophy of really defining your audience by problems or challenges they face, right? So for me, for years, it was folks that were in corporate jobs who wanted to leave and start a business, right? And within that, there's a whole bunch of sub problems that they face. What business should I start? How do I create a website? You know, how do I find my first customers? So when you're thinking in terms of your audience based on the problems and challenges that they face on a regular, consistent basis, you want to be producing content that helps them to solve their problem, right? So if you're going to do a talk in front of a live group of people who might be ideal clients, be as relentlessly helpful as you can. Really think about what are some of the core challenges that they have and design a talk to be super helpful. I found that that's something that just always really endears people to you. They get concrete takeaways, and then they can be very interested in learning more about you and what you offer. The consistency in this regularity is so important, because you can't just 1 week send out a whole bunch of information and then do nothing for 2 months, you know, which is often what we do, right? We don't have any clients. We panic. We do a bunch of marketing activities. We get clients. We do nothing until, you know, the projects dry up and all of a sudden we go on this whole marketing offensive again. So consistency is really important. Think about it like a breadcrumb trail that you're leaving behind you. If we were to audit your listeners' social media profiles, right? See the communication that's coming out of your business, how you're showing up on social media. Would people know what you do? Would they feel like they're getting useful information and resources to solve their problems? And if not, if your information is all over the place, it's probably because you haven't taken the time to define the problems you're solving, and then you have not been consistent with delivering that information.
Now, are you seeing at the small business level an alignment between sales and marketing, where they work together, where you know, the marketing folks are doing their own thing and the salespeople are doing their own thing, or is it now evolved with all this marketing automation where they are collaborating a lot more?
I like to see it. I think it kind of depends who's in larger companies, who's really managing those departments, right? Because historically, there has been a division that doesn't make any sense between markets. But where people do see that, you know, lead generation, my friend Michelle Woodward always says, you know, marketing is what you get to get your phone to ring, or, you know, email to ding. And then sales is what you say when you pick up the phone, right? Or you answer the email. So they're intimately related. There should be alignment between, you know, who it is that you're bringing in the door and the messaging, so that salespeople can do their job effectively. But because a lot of the marketing automation can bring leads to us in a much more efficient way, then I think there is a much clearer understanding. Whereas, you know, if I look at past decades where you didn't have that, you know, those same kinds of things, salespeople were doing a lot of the, you know, shaking hands and meeting people and cold calling and all these activities.
Can you share some of the people that maybe blogs you read or marketers that you think are influential that the small to mid-sized business owners should be paying attention to?
Yeah, I'm always a fan in the long term of Seth Godin. I feel like he always provides really wonderful, consistent advice and feedback. I also love, for small business owners, Melinda Emerson, who's the small biz lady, who gives really great, consistent, effective information and advice. And also Lamar Tyler from, I think, Sales and Traffic Academy is another great thought leader that's providing a lot of more the online marketing and sales advice.
Well, thank you so much for being part of this today. If somebody wants to learn more about what you're up to, whether it's your brick and mortar small business lab or your own consulting, what's the best place to find you?
You can find me at PamelaSlim.com.
And then the same, you can find the brick and mortar small biz lab as well?
Yep, everything's there. Uh-huh.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show. It was great to chat with you. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Marketing Superheroes.